You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Wendy Davis has redefined pro-life. Bill Maher asks the question, basically summarizes what we've been saying for the last couple of days here on this pro-life for years, but has been said so well, actually, I think, by a number of people. And I've been hammering on this. In fact, we had this conversation yesterday with Patrice Hill? Yeah, who is the writer for the Washington Times, about how the Welfare Reform Act of 1996 created a new business model for Walmart. Really? Anyhow, I want to talk about this question. The Guardian is asking this question, where do all the angry white men come from? I have an answer for you for that. The strongest storm on Earth is heading for the Philippines right now. Super Typhoon Haiyan. And the people in the Philippines are getting rather nervous. I flew into the Philippines on the tail end or the leading edge of, I forget. No, it must have been the tail end, because when I was there, the typhoon wasn't going over. So it must have been the tail end of Typhoon Stephen. And that was wild. It was the only time I've ever been on a plane where the plane was pitching around so much that the overhead baggage compartments were popping open and stuff was falling out. Never seen that happen before. It was a 747, it was a great big airplane, and the plane was just slamming around in the air. And there was so much flexing of that fuselage going on that a couple of the overhead bags popped open and people were pretty freaked out. I mean, flying through a typhoon. It was on Philippine Airlines, too, which doesn't give you the greatest of confidence. So anyway, don't take typhoons lightly, I guess, is the message of that. So, Jeff Foxworthy has this old thing, you might be a redneck if, right? Well, you might have been fooled by the Republicans if is the title of my little riff here. If you think the Republicans really care about every embryo turning into a living, breathing baby 9 months later, then you've been fooled by the Republican Party. New investigations by the website RH Reality Check and Politico have discovered that the Koch-tipus, Charles and David Koch, have spent tens of millions of dollars of their personal fortunes to fund the forced pregnancy movement. According to RH Reality Check's Adele Stan, tax documents show that the Koch-tipus directed pro-business groups. Now, you have to ask yourself the question, why would a pro-business group be funding legislative initiatives across America that are designed to close women's health clinics, deny women access to contraception, reproductive health services, or abortions? Even deny women access to things like birth control pills. So despite the millions that the Kochs have spent on the anti-choice movement, make no mistake about it, they, like the rest of the institutional Republican Party, they really don't give a rat's patootie about whether or not a woman has an abortion. What they care about, and this is a really important distinction, and once you understand this, then a lot of stuff falls into place, including the answer to questions like, where did all the angry white men come from? Instead, what they care about is protecting the Republican brand, the interests of big business. And the only way that they can protect that Republican brand is to keep Republicans in power. And the only way they can do that, which allows them to further the interests of the big businesses that they actually represent and the billionaires, is to bring together a whole bunch of small sliver-sized single interest groups like the pro-life movement as one of those slivers under one big umbrella and convince them that Republicans care about their issues. They have to build their coalition this way because if they were honest about their governing philosophy, they'd lose every single election. You notice how Rand Paul the other day, he said, Rachel Maddow pointing out that he's a plagiarist, he's being attacked by hacks and haters. Well, the Republicans have been reaching out to the haters. Why? Why does having, the Confederate flag-loving, guys in the Republican Party, why does that help the business agenda? Well, there's a really simple answer. It gets Republicans elected, and then they can do the business agenda. Democrats have a clear governing philosophy, and that's to do whatever it takes to protect average, hardworking, everyday Americans. I mean, we've seen that philosophy played out with the Democrats' support of the labor movement, the environment, Medicare, food stamps, unemployment insurance, Social Security, universal health care. I mean, the list goes on and on. But unlike the Democrats, the Republicans have a much more narrow governing philosophy. The only thing they really care about is protecting big business and billionaires, the wealthy elite. And here's the problem. When that's your governing philosophy, I mean, if the Republicans just, if John Boehner just came out and said, you know, the only bills I'm bringing to the floor are those that protect billionaires, which is pretty much what he does. But if he said that, you know, if he just told the truth about it, or Mitch McTurtle or any of these guys, they would have a very hard time getting average people to vote for them. And thus, they would not win elections. So what the Republicans had to do, and they really started putting this together, this was Nixon's Southern strategy, was the genesis of this. Bring in the white racists from the South into the Republican Party. They had to create a coalition of supporters by bringing together people and groups who really don't care and may not even agree with helping corporations and rich people, but they're so concerned about things like abortion or guns or God that they're going to get in bed with the billionaires to advance their own personal agendas, their own personal passion. So the Republicans go out, they find these passionate single interest groups, And pull them together under the big GOP elephant with the upside-down stars on its side. You know, maybe they're even trying to get the devil worshippers. They go to the pro-life movement. They say, you know, if you believe that life begins at conception, you might be a Republican. They go to gun lovers and say, if you think that everyone has the right to carry a military assault weapon to protect themselves from hordes of angry black people marching down Main Street, you might be a Republican. They go to climate change deniers and say, if you think the scientists are self-serving and global warming is perfectly normal, you might be a Republican. They go to homophobes and say, if you hate gay people, then you must be a Republican. And finally, Republicans go to the overworked and underpaid white people, the working poor and the middle class. And they say, if you think that poor people are really mostly black and Hispanic lazy bums who don't deserve your help, then you're definitely a Republican. This is how Republicans win elections and hold power. They just bring in enough useful idiots to get themselves elected. Most of these positions don't advance the major principles of the Republican Party, which is supporting the billionaires and protecting big business, but others do. When Republicans reach out to climate change deniers, they're really trying to protect the bottom lines of big oil. When Republicans bring gun lovers under the umbrella, they're really protecting the profits of America's military-industrial complex and our weapons manufacturing and multi-billion-dollar industry. So when you see news stories about how billionaires and business groups like the Koch brothers are supporting things like forced ultrasounds or opposing gay marriage, it should remind you that what they're really doing is they're calling out to the useful idiots that they need to win elections. They already have the rich people and the corporations in their back pocket. So, but if they want to win an election, they got to add the useful idiots to that. And that's what they're doing. And they're doing it very, very successfully. And so the question here, Ali Fogg over at The Guardian today, the headline, where do all the angry white men come from? I'll tell you where they come from. They come from people who 20 and 30 years ago were making enough that they could support that one man could support an entire family with one job. And now he has to work, his wife has to work, his kids have to work, their credit card's maxed out, their house, their home is underwater, their kid has a $20,000 student debt, and Fox News comes along and says it's those black people on welfare.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Or it's those gay people who want to get married, or whatever. I mean, you know, it's like it's always somebody else's fault. That's where these angry white people come. Welcome back. Nate Sweet is with us. He is a producer with The Big Picture. Hey, Nate, how you doing today?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Fine, thank you. So we're going to start out with a need-to-know rant.
Yeah, we're talking to Mike Papantonio about the hypocrisy of the Republican position on food stamp cuts, considering that, you know, Tennessee legislator like Stephen Fincher is taking over $3 million in federal farm bill subsidies since 1999, and he's, pushing pretty strongly for cuts to food stamps. We're going to get into that with PAP. We'll also be looking at, new New York Times report shows that some of the biggest billionaires in the country, like Paul Allen and Charles Schwab, are receiving farm bill subsidies as well, and sort of dig into the weird hypocrisies when it comes to the farm bill.
And the Republicans wanted to split the farm bill. They wanted to split the food stamp part apart from the subsidies to Paul Allen part, so that they can continue to give subsidies to billionaires. And by the way, another one of the big recipients of the food farm bill subsidies is Michelle Bachmann.
Yeah.
And they want to continue to pass that money out, but they want to cut off the food stamp money because that's going to poor people. And whenever Fox says the phrase poor people, even though the majority of poor people in the United States are white, the way that they say it on Fox News and the way that they say it on talk radio just has that edge that these are people of color.
Exactly. And I think one of the sad things about this whole situation is, we're going to get into this with PAP, is that a lot of Democrats have adopted that sort of cut first, think later thinking of the Republican Party. Democrats, I mean, let's not forget, they're pushing for $4 billion in cuts to the food stamp program as well, which is still a significant amount. For
on top of the $5 billion that just got cut last week.
Exactly. It's almost as much as it was just cut out from automatic funding from this when the stimulus provision expired.
Yeah.
Moving on from that, in Block B, we're going to be trying to talk to someone. We will be talking to Gordon Lafer about the preemption bill efforts that are being supported by ALEC all across the country. ALEC is trying to get state legislators and municipalities to pass bills that would prevent sick leave legislation from being implemented in those states. ALEC's behind some of the most savage anti-worker legislation. This is just their latest effort. We'll be talking about that. And then we're trying to get someone on to talk about the CIA and AT&T's cooperation regards some phone metadata trawling overseas.
I find this so incredible, Nate. You and I work together. If you were sick, I would rather you didn't come to work because I don't want to get it, right? In fact, Shane was sick on Tuesday. He took Tuesday and Wednesday off. Am I right? Yeah. You weren't feeling so good on Monday. Probably shouldn't have come in. But in any case, and I'm please to pay your all salaries while you're gone, just so I don't have to get sick, right? I mean, as a business owner, this seems to me like, common sense 101. What kind of idiot business owner would want to say, when my employees are sick, they have to come in, unless it happens to be somebody like the Koch brothers, who are so remote from their business, they're not working in the Georgia-Pacific factories. They don't have to interact with their workers, so they're not the ones who are going to get sick. But even then, if a sick person comes in and makes three or four other people sick, that hurts productivity. I don't get it. What's the rationale for this?
I mean, what's especially confusing to me is the fact that some of the groups behind this some of the institutions that oppose sick leave legislation are restaurants. And supposedly small business owners.
Yeah, so here we are in cold and flu season, and let's go into the restaurant, and they have no sick leave policy. So as the waiter or waitress or whatever, the food server is bringing your food out, they're sneezing on your plate, right?
Yeah.
I mean, really?
Sounds like great policy,
Oh man, this is beyond ugly. It's stupid too. Nate Sweet, thanks a lot, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. So, I want to finish this rant. I just want to get into this whole thing. You've heard me say before that Republicans have not held the White House since the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower, and he arguably, in fact, everybody thought in 1951 when he was debating, and 52, throughout 52, as he was 51, I guess he was contemplating running for, I don't remember it was the year I was born, but I've read the histories of the time, that he was contemplating running for president, and both parties were courting him because he was this famous general who won World War II. And he ended up running as a Republican in 52 and winning. And I think that was a wise choice for him, because you'd had Democratic rule basically in the United States from 1932 to 1952. What's that? 20 years of Democratic presidencies. And Harry Truman won by a squeaker against Dewey. And America was ready to elect a Republican, give him a chance. So they elected Eisenhower, and he was really a moderate Republican back when that actually meant something. in 56 when he ran for re-election. We have read this on this program, his political platform, his party platform. We've played his ads on this show where they brag about expanding Social Security. This is in 56 when he ran for re-election. He was bragging about how he increased the number of people in the union rolls. He increased the number of people eligible for Social Security, expanded Social Security disability benefits. He introduced the Occupational Health and Safety Act and gave workplace protection to workers. I mean, as I recall, Eisenhower did a bunch of what you and I might call progressive or at least typically Democratic stuff, big D Democratic stuff. People loved him and they reelected him, even if Eisenhower had as his vice president Richard Nixon. You know, he kind of didn't talk about that so much. And in 1952, when he ran for president, he ran as the peace candidate. Now, the only other guy that I know of in my lifetime who ran as a peace candidate successfully, now McGovern ran as a peace candidate unsuccessfully, you know, against Richard Nixon in, what would that have been, the election of 72, it must have been. But the only other person I know who ran as a peace candidate was Barack Obama. You know, in 2008, he ran on, I'm going to, you know, get us out of Iraq. It was a stupid war, and I'm going to wind down the war in Afghanistan after I win it, basically, which was, you know, the political thing to say, I suppose. But you've got the Eisenhower clip there, Shane. This is the ad. This is literally the ad in 1952 that Dwight Eisenhower ran for president on. Listen to this.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
A paid film.
Vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. That was his slogan. In 1952, it got him elected. Well, we were Harry Truman had started this war with North Korea, or North Korea started a war with South Korea, and Harry Truman went to their defense, and it was a very unpopular war. Not unlike Vietnam in some ways, and so Eisenhower said, you know, I'll be the peace candidate. So anyhow, that all happened, but this question. Where are all the angry white men coming from? They were around back then, but they were the fringe. We had, during that era, that was sort of the era when legal apartheid was slowly coming to an end, more rapidly in the 60s and 70s and 80s. 60s and 70s, really. But really the thing that I think is driving the whole Tea Party rage thing, the don't mess with Texas stuff, the Ted Cruz phenomena that gets Republicans elected, is this idea that white working people have been victimized. And they have. In fact, all working people have been victimized. Wages have been flat for 32 years. So the white working people seem to think that they're the only ones who are getting it, right? And so the Republicans come along and say, oh, look at this, with quotas and preferences and affirmative action, black people are taking your jobs, and foreign people are taking your jobs, and look at those immigrants, they're taking your jobs. Well, you didn't have a job washing people's toilets before? Oh, well, maybe they're not. But yeah, but still, we'll tell you that they're taking your jobs or picking lettuce. But the point is, that working people, they may not be politically sophisticated, they may not be well educated. Our schools no longer teach civics in any meaningful way, but they're not dumb. They know they've been screwed. What they don't know is who screwed them. They don't realize that Walmart and all these big chains came up with a whole new business model in the 90s as a result of welfare reform that stepped off perfectly from Ronald Reagan's war on organized labor in 1981, when he fired Patco and put the first head of the Department of Labor who was hostile to labor in charge of the Department of Labor, just like he put Bill Bennett, the first head of the Department of Education, who hated and wanted to dissolve the Department of Education. So Reagan started it, the 96 Welfare Act and ending welfare as we know it, made turned it into a business model, turned it into a profit center for Walmart. And so comes Bill Maher, and he asked this question, and this is perfect. He said, this is the question the right has to answer. Do you want smaller government with less handouts, or do you want a low minimum wage? Because you can't have both. If Colonel Sanders isn't going to pay the lady behind the counter enough to live on, then Uncle Sam has to. And I, for one, am getting a little tired of helping highly profitable companies pay their workers. That's what's going on. And the big challenge that the Democratic Party has right now, and progressives in general, is telling those angry white people out there that they've been screwed by the Republicans.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's not that they're being screwed by people of color or immigrants. They're being screwed, too. It's that they're being screwed by the big corporations. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 28 minutes before the hour. And so anyway, I've laid this out. You know why I think that you've got these this angry white, which is basically a.k.a. Tea Party. Wendy Davis, by the way, did this marvelous thing. She said this is a speech she gave at the University of Texas at Brownsville day before yesterday. She said, I am pro-life. I care about the life of every child who goes to bed hungry, every child who goes to bed without a proper education, every child who goes to bed without being able to be a part of the Texas dream, every woman and man who worry about their children's future and their ability to provide for that future. I care about life, and I have a record of fighting for people above all else. This isn't about protecting abortion. It's about protecting women. It's about trusting women to make good decisions for themselves and empowering them with the tools to do that. That's a great quote. And, of course, the quote from Bill Maher. So, anyhow, a lot of you want to weigh in on these various topics. Paul in Westover, Maryland, it says you want to disagree with me about what?
Hey, Tom.
Hi, Paul.
Well, the first thing, I don't think that they're really angry white man, per se. I think what they are is they're men at work, and they do for themselves, and they're not looking for any handouts. Most of them, they're not rich. They're paycheck to paycheck, much like me. I talk to a lot of them. I've been a truck driver for 35 years, been around the country, and I talk to just about everybody I meet. And I believe that what it is they see government taxation getting bigger and bigger and bigger to take care of people, some poor who need to be taken care of, and we are glad to help, but a lot of them, they rape the system. They see a system that the government is creating, and they use every advantage they can. And as they do that, they have no self-worth to actually get off the system, get back to work, like somebody who feels that they have worth.
That might have been true, Paul, before 1996, but you can't go on welfare for more than 4 years now, period. So this whole multi-generational, people have no self-worth stuff, it's nonsense. It no longer exists in the United States, number one. Number two, the vast majority of people who are on any kind of benefits at all, whether it's Medicaid, food stamps, housing assistance, the vast majority of them are either elderly, children, or working poor. But number three, I agree with you. I think we're saying the same thing. I would say that these, by and large, men who remember, many of them are old enough to remember a time when a single man working was enough to raise a family, take a vacation every year, pay off the house, have a pension, look at a decent retirement, put their kids through school, and now they're living paycheck to paycheck. They feel emasculated. They feel like their identity, I'm the man, I'm the provider, has been stolen from them, and it has. We have seen from the George Washington administration to the Ronald Reagan administration, as productivity went up. Now, productivity is, you know, how much an individual worker can produce for a company, and it's another way of fancy way of saying actually corporate profits. As profits have gone up, wages have gone up. And then starting with the Reagan administration, productivity continued to incline at about the same rate it has since the Washington administration, but wages went totally flat. And all the money that was created by that giant gap that was formed by that, that all went to the top 1%. And the working people were, you know, they were faced with their housing costs were still going up, their food costs were still going up, their transportation costs were still going up, but their pay was not going up. For 32 years, this has been the case. And so the first thing they did is they sent their wives to work. They said women entered the workforce in huge numbers in the 70s. But that wasn't enough to maintain households. And it added a whole new set of expenses, like child care expenses. So then people started using their home as an ATM. And instead of building up equity in their home, so like when my dad died, you know, a decade or so ago, in 2006, his house was completely paid off. Instead, people are taking whatever equity they have in their house and they're borrowing against it until their house is underwater. Then when they max that out, they max out their credit cards. Then when they max out their credit cards and they say to their kids, I'm sorry, I can't pay for your college education like I said I would. You're going to have to take out a $50,000 student loan to get that degree. And now we have private debt in the United States. Everybody's hysterical. All Republicans are constantly hysterical about our public debt, right? The debt of the federal government. It's a $16, $17 trillion. Private debt in the United States right now is $54 trillion. We're wiped out. And we've been wiped out by 32 years of Reaganomics. And people get really upset about that. And I absolutely understand that. And it is a totally justified upset. What they don't realize is that it was changes made in the way that business is done in the United States, in the legal and tax construct, by the Reagan administration, by and large, and a few made during the Clinton administration, pushed largely by Newt Gingrich, that have resulted in this transformation of the middle class, independent, I'm a man, I can take care of my family, workforce, transformation of them into a, I can only get by if my wife works too, and maybe if my kid works, and if we rent out the back room to Aunt Sally or the guy down the street. Am I making sense, Paul?
Yes, you're making total sense.
Okay.
But I do think it was actually before Reaganomics, because that was when Jimmy Carter was president back then, and we had a lot of problems back then with the economy. Up to 24% interest rate going, and
yeah, but that was paying off the war in Vietnam. I mean, that's what Paul Volcker had to do, because Richard Nixon had extended the war in Vietnam for an extra 5 years longer than it needed to be, and put it all on a credit card, the same way George W. Bush put both Iraq and Afghanistan on the credit card. The credit card had to be paid off. And the only way to pay off that credit card was to devalue the American currency so we could pay it off with cheaper dollars. The way you do that is with inflation. So Paul Volcker jacked up inflation, and it happened during the tail end of the Ford administration, the last 2 years of the Ford administration, and the Carter administration, and the first year and a half of the Reagan administration. And that basically was how long it took us to pay off the debt of the Vietnam War, combined with the fact that in the middle of the Carter administration, or actually at the end of the Nixon administration, you had, and then again during the Carter administration, it happened twice in about a 10-year period, you had the Arabs cut off our oil, which tripled and quadrupled the price of oil, which, you know, made everything much more expensive and drove inflation as well.
Yeah, I remember those days.
Neither of these things are the fault of working people.
I was pumping fuel as a younger guy then.
Yeah. I mean, neither of these things were the fault of working people. One was, you know, a horrible war policy. And we're going to see the same thing, frankly. I think, you know, 5-10 years down the road, you're going to see huge inflation, because we're going to have to start paying off Iraq and Afghanistan. And also this oil thing. I mean, you may be like I am, old enough to remember when gasoline was 22, 25 cents a gallon, you know, 4 gallons for a buck. And there were 4 gas stations on every corner, and everybody was competing. And those days are long gone, and they started falling apart with the first Arab oil embargo. And I forget the year. I think it might have been 71, 72. It was right around in there. And then the second Arab oil embargo, and what they did was they contributed to inflation. But that had, you know, that's not what has really whacked the American working people. That's used by the Republicans to beat up on Jimmy Carter as if he was somehow responsible for it. He had nothing to do with it at all. And in fact, Paul Volcker, arguably the head of the Fed at the time, arguably was a Republican, but he was basically dealing the hand that was dealt him. I mean, he was, you know, playing the hand that was dealt him. But this this war on working people. This began in the spring of 1981 when Ronald Reagan took on PATCO and said, we're going to start busting unions in the United States. When he came into power, roughly a third of all workers in the United States were unionized. And now it's about 6% in the private workforce. And what has happened is that, you know, as unions go away, wages go away. Benefits go away. It's real, real simple when workers don't have power. Paul, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. But I'm telling you, it ain't people on welfare that's driving the problem. That, you know, you and I are paying $36, the average person making $50,000 a year is paying $36 a year for food stamps and paying $5,000 a year, for corporate subsidies. Bob in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, that's a good point about taxes being where they are. Most of that is going to corporate welfare.
Yeah.
I wanted to say that you hit the nail right on the head about the Republicans only representing billionaires. I come from a staunch Republican family. My grandfather was a Republican congressman, but I gradually realized the truth about them. One thing I would add is I think I know why the Republicans are anti-choice for women when it comes to abortion and birth control. It took me quite a long time to figure it out. They want to increase the population to make more soldiers and to drive down wages for working people.
Well, Pat Buchanan talks about how he's pretty hysterical about how whites are not reproducing at a fast enough rate. I mean, that might have something to do with it.
Yeah, right. But if they take away abortion rights and birth control rights, that leads to an increased population.
Yeah, and you got a lot of serfs. You got a lot of people that you can throw at a war, and you got a lot of people who will work for almost nothing. Could be, Bob. Thanks a lot for the call. 15 minutes past the hour, or before the hour. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, my new book, The Crash of 2016, is out. It should be hitting bookstores near you any day now, and libraries as well, if you call and ask for it. And I'll share with you my book tour after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Because next week it's going to be, you know, on the road, Mac. Well, actually, I am coming back, so some more, yeah. We'll be back. Okay, I just can't find it. Welcome back. Let's see here. Free Speech TV, George in Sedona, Arizona. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
George, this is George.
Hey, George.
A few months ago, I called, but first of all, I wanted to give you an accolade. To me, you're one of the true patriots in this whole country. But other than that, I think it's genetic, isn't it? When you said angry white man, I immediately thought about the beginning of 2001 Space Odyssey, where the ape picked up the bone and started killing other apes and capturing the water supply. But I asked you about probably 5-6 months ago how we could possibly be optimistic when there is so much negativity going on in this country and around the world, and you said, it was possible to be optimistic. And yet every day, day after day, I listen and I watch and read the papers, and I can't possibly see any future. I really can't. I've lived and worked in two different countries. I've been a merchant seaman. I was 35 years in New Zealand, Australia, another 8 years, and other places can have a liberal and a conservative 4 years at a time, one and the other, you know, and things change very quietly. And just one last thing. I know I'm taking up too much time, but...
No, it's fine.
A few weeks ago, you had... Name the capitalist party, and I don't know if anybody had ever thought of Hooverville capitalism.
That's a good one. That harkens back to the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up just at the end of it, probably. I was born in 1938. Mm-hmm. My dad was still working on Boulder Dam, which was a good project, you know,
yeah,
put out by Roosevelt. And we grew up poor, and I'm still poor, and I just opened the paper this morning, and I've got a new way of regulating what poverty is in this country, and it doesn't look very good.
Yeah. Well, here's the good news. Senator Sherrod Brown has just introduced legislation to raise Social Security payments by $70 a month, to adjust to change the cost of living adjustment for Social Security recipients so that it actually reflects what elderly people pay for, things like pharmaceuticals, rather than things like the newest iPhone, you know, which, and the prices tend to be going down on those things. And that would remove the cap so that Bill Gates gets to pay into Social Security what, you know, every other working person in America is paying into Social Security. So, I don't know if you can still hear me. You can still hear me, George, but I think our TV just freaked out.
Yeah, I hear you, God bless you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, George. Thanks very much for the call. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1 week from today, I will be in Chicago at the Frugal Muse, actually in Darien in suburban Chicago. The Frugal Muse is the bookstore. It's 7 p.m. I'll be giving a talk and signing books. I've been to the Frugal Muse many times. It's a wonderful bookstore out there in suburban Darien, the Darien suburb of Chicago. So be there, be square. That's a week from tonight. A week from Saturday, November 16th, I'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Of all these events, this is the only one that's ticketed. So you actually, if you're going to come see me in Minneapolis, the cost of the ticket includes a book and food and drinks. And so you go to am950radio.com for information on that. But that's Saturday night from 6 to 9 p.m. I'll be at the Operating Engineers Hall, Saturday the 16th of November in Minneapolis. Then on the following Tuesday, I'll be in Denver, Tuesday, November 19th, at the Tattered Cover at 7:30 p.m. It's free, open to the public. I'll be doing a speech and a book signing. I've been at the Tattered Cover before, marvelous bookstore. And on November 20th, I'll be in Los Angeles at the Santa Monica Women's Club at 7 p.m. So if you're in L.A., Wednesday, November 20th. San Francisco, Thursday, November 21st at the Commonwealth Club at noon. I've been there before. Friday, November 22nd, I'll be in Portland at Powell's, back in my old stomping grounds. And I've done a bunch of book signings in Powell's over the years. It's always wonderful to be there. And then in December 3rd, I'll be here in Washington, D.C. at Politics and Prose. So the stuff coming up next week, Chicago next Thursday, Minneapolis next Saturday. So just to put it on your radar screen. And we are still struggling to get this stuff on our website for some reason. I don't understand, but we'll get it there. Anyway, Everett in Kenmore, Washington. Hey, Everett, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I must agree with your last caller, George. You're a true patriot. You rock, and we love you. I've got two quick questions. This not necessarily on your topic of the day, except for that I am an angry, white, progressive man. I'm angry about the way the media already calls elections before even, you know, half of the votes have been counted yet. And RT and even your show called the 522, which is the labeling of genetically engineered foods here in Washington, the morning after election day. And there were still hundreds of thousands of votes to be counted. In fact, today it was last updated about 2 hours ago, mm-hmm. and there's still 420,000 votes to be counted. And I think it's like 130,000 close to it here in progressive King County.
Right.
And
so you think you might still pull out a win, because we were working off just, you know, generic AP reports. I mean, the mainstream news media was reporting that that thing had lost.
Well, I mean, we might lose, but it's going to be a lot closer than they were calling, and it's still a possibility that we could win with that many votes still out.
Yeah. Well, let's hope so, Everett. Let's hope so.
90-something thousand different.
But you're right. That, you know, in Washington State, that was mostly a vote-by-mail vote or exclusively a vote-by-mail vote, and so it takes 3-4 days for those votes to be counted. And that caveat should have been added. I was actually, frankly, I was unaware of that until yesterday when Mark Taylor Canfield called in and reported on that. And but he was of the opinion that the ballot measure had almost certainly been defeated. But we'll see. Okay, I'm with you. I will be more sensitive to that in the future. Thank you for the heads up.
That happens a lot. I mean, with you know, they call elections before they're even, you know, finished counting. You know, and my other question, it was here in Washington, like you said, we vote by mail, but the votes are tallied through computerized scanners, which, you know, they go into a computer, and once they're in there, I have the fear that, you know, they could possibly be manipulated, just like in electronic voting machines.
Right. That's a concern that I have as well, and I think that we should pass a law saying that I don't have a problem with the scanners. The problem that I have is that in every case that I know of, there may be some that I'm wrong, but every case that I know of, those scanners are owned by private for-profit companies, and they control the software in the scanner. And you know, it's a black box, basically. And it should be I don't care if a private company makes it. Just, you know, just like I don't care if, you know, the FBI is driving around in a Ford, right? You know, the FBI doesn't need to start a car factory in order to have cars. But they buy that Ford. They buy that car. And if they're going to outfit it and make it fancy and put a police radio in it and all that other stuff, you know, that's theirs to do. So I think that government agencies should buy the optical scanners from whoever makes them, should program them with transparent, publicly available source code, so everybody can see the source code, and should own them and maintain them with people who are answerable to we the people. So on that count, I think we probably agree. Everett, thank you for the call. Walter in Albuquerque, listening on KABQ. We got just a minute until the end of this hour. Walter, it's yours.
Hi, Tom. The name is Water, not Walter.
Oh, Water. I'm sorry.
I wanted to remind you, George McGovern and Adlai Stevenson were both peace candidates for president.
Yes. Well, I mentioned McGovern. I had forgotten about Stevenson.
Wait a minute. Don't Mess With Texas was about the environment, not about politics. And Nixon, while he was president, spent more money on the anti-poverty program than any other president before or since.
Really? Where did you get that statistic?
My father was the regional director, which meant he directed one quarter of the anti-poverty program under Nixon. And my father is more progressive than progressive.
Yeah. Now, how did that compare with the Great Society? Because LBJ came along after Nixon and just really ramped up spending.
Nixon spent way more.
Really?
Johnson did.
Interesting. Water, if you can find a link or you get anything to back that up, I would love to see it. I'd love to know about it. I'd love to, you know, proclaim that. Republicans, go back to your roots. If you could post it on our blog over at tomhartman.com, I'd surely appreciate it. Thanks for listening to KABQ. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com. And our website, tomhartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at tomhartman.com. Thank you.
listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and Mike Papantonio is on the line with us.
Tom, how are you?
I'm great. How are you, Pap?
Good.
The attorney, the host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com, Ring of Fire TV, also on Free Speech TV. So, killing the poor. Really?
Well, which way? I mean, there's so
let me set you off on this rant, Pap. Pap attack of the day. Go for it.
Well, here it is. I mean, you've got there's two stories that I've been talking about all day today on radio, and that is that obviously we kill the poor by taking $47 million away from in food stamps while we're giving while we're taking billionaires. And this is an interesting number. Billionaires worth $316 million are owners of companies that are getting subsidies from the government in the farm bill while we're taking $47 million away from people who can't afford to eat in the farm bill. That's just part of it. You know where we're really going to see it, Tom?
Hmm.
We're going to see it in January and February.
Yeah.
January and February, what's going to happen is you're going to have – it's already done. I mean, I feel almost foolish talking about what might happen in January and February because I know what's going to happen. It's already done. The Feinsteins have won. The Erskine Bowles crowd has won. And you're going to see the Democrats give up the rights of working poor so billionaires can make more money. And you hear the arguments already. Tune in if you can stomach it without a gag reflex. Watch Sunday programming where you're going to hear you're going to hear all the talking heads, whether it's Feinstein, whether it's Durbin, Warner, you name it. They're talking about the idea that, gee whiz, we have to give up these rights for the working poor because we need more revenue. And it's already been done. And you have Obama talking about his code words are, gee whiz, we can't really take anything off the table at this point. This is going to be a very ugly story. Wall Street Democrats are in charge of the narrative, and it's really unfortunate for the average American middle class or working poor.
Yeah, and in some ways this goes back to when Wall Street took over the Democratic Party, and not just Wall Street, when business took over the Democratic Party. And I think a lot of that tracks back to that Buckley versus Vallejo decision.
Yes.
And the Powell memo, you know, this strategy by big business and Lewis Powell, of course, representing the tobacco industries at the time, to insert money into our political discourse to the point that pretty much no political party or politician, unless they were in a small enough state like Bernie Sanders is in Vermont, where he's probably shaken the hand of every person in that state three times in all the years he's represented them. I know he shook my hand twice before I even, you know, knew him personally. I mean,
he's a real thing.
Yeah, just show up and there's, hey, let's go into town on Saturday. Oh, who's that in the middle of town in the town square? Oh, it's Bernie Sanders. He's holding town meeting. I mean, if you've got the luxury of doing that, but, you know, you can't do that in New York State. You can't do that in California and can't do that in Michigan. And so what has happened is that money has replaced that. And we now have a wholly owned Republican Party and a partially owned Democratic Party. And I think we can track it all back to the royalists. So Louise and I had dinner last night with a friend from the UK who next week is being knighted or whatever they call it by the Queen. She's getting an OBE, Order of the British Empire. It's like this great. She'll bow down before the Queen and the whole whoop-de-doop for some incredible stuff that she's done, and it hit me. The Queen of England has less power than the Supreme Court does. She does not have the power to strike down laws passed by Congress or signed by the Prime Minister or the President. She can dissolve Parliament, but it just comes right back, you know, in a place. She can't strike down laws. Our Supreme Court has, through this doctrine of judicial review and the misuse of it with this money is speech and corporations are persons thing, they have become the kings of this country. And there is no kingdom in the Western world. There's still a king and there's a queen in the Netherlands. There's a king or a queen in Denmark and in Norway. They don't have the power that the Supreme Court does, Pap.
Well, wait till you see McCutcheon. Wait till you get a load of what they're going to do to us with McCutcheon that is going to be, the majority right-wing boobs that are now, you know, politicos, basically they're politicians with black robes.
Yes.
They're going to grant the McCutcheon relief that they're asked for, and there are going to be no rules on it. But look, Dianne Feinstein, Max Baucus, Joe Manchin, Chris Coons, Tom Carper, Michael Bennett, there's not an ounce of Democratic blood running through these people, except maybe on social issues. And see, if you follow the news today is they're talking about social issues. Now, don't get me wrong. These are important social issues, whether it has to do with immigration, whether it has to do with gender rights. They're important social issues. But where it comes to the bread and butter issues that affect Americans who are trying to feed their family, these are the Wall Street Democrats that have, it's almost, Tom, what it is, it's almost, look at this shiny thing over here that I'm doing for you.
No, the Democrats are doing the same thing with gay marriage that the Republicans do with abortion.
Completely. And so don't pay attention to what's taking place behind the curtain, because the Democrats have made this unholy bond with Wall Street. Tom, let me tell you something. You may think that this is absolutely way out there. It's not. You will start seeing Koch brother type money moving into Democratic races at state levels. That's the first place you'll see it. You already have the Koch money moving into things like city commissioners and, you know, dog catcher races, for God's sakes. That money will move in. Matter of fact, tomorrow I'm going to be interviewing somebody running for state house position that's running against this Koch type money. They're Democrat, but their money's coming wholly from corporate America, AT&T, all types of dark money avenues, that when we start looking at it, Kochs are actually empowering, by this next election, we'll see them empowering Democrats because they're so certain that Democrats have lost their moral compass. Hmm. And so, who would have dreamed that? I never would even thought of saying such a thing even a year ago. But now it's a different story with McCutcheon, it's going to be even more of a probability.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do we do about it?
Well, I think the thing to do is, at some point we have to stop being nice. Mm-hmm. This idea of gee whiz, the media is going to take care of us, or some small faction of the Democratic Party is going to take care of us. The problem, Tom, is the cavalry is not coming. Okay, and this is very difficult for people to understand. The cavalry is not coming. You're not going to wake up tomorrow and have somebody solving your problems. And the only way to push this administration moving into January and February is the same thing we've seen on gender rights, where pushback was so strong that Obama had to react.
Right.
Syria, pushback was so strong, Obama had to react. Larry Summers, pushback was strong. But where did the pushback take place? Took place in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Took place on the social media. Social media is very powerful. This is a president who believes that he is going to have a legacy that's meaningful. And if he continues this course, he's not going to have a meaningful legacy. It's going to be one he's going to look back at and be embarrassed. We should help him from having to do that. We should help him not be embarrassed when he looks back and says, this is what I accomplished for the American people.
So it's the getting out in the streets. It's like movetoamend.org now has over 500
yes.
local chapters around the country. Progressive
yes.
Democrats of America, over 300 chapters, local chapters around the country, pdamerica.org. There are groups that are completely independent of any political party
right.
that are transforming America right now as we speak, that people can participate in. And good progressives can show up at the local Democratic Party and say, I want to run for precinct committee chair. And then they get to write the party platform and decide who's going to be in the primaries.
We can hope for that day, can't we?
Yeah. Well, this is, look at the Concord Project, how they taught
right.
Tea Partiers how to take over the Republican Party. They were incredibly successful. I got to send you the videos on that sometime. Have you seen those videos?
I haven't.
Oh, I got to send you this. This is amazing. Anyhow, Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
ringoffireradio.com. Ring of Fire is just absolutely one of the best weekend programs on the one of the best programs on the air. Check it out. We'll be back. Welcome back. And Mike Papantonio is still with us. And Pap, tell us about Ring of Fire
TV.
What's going on with the TV show this week on Free Speech TV?
Farron Cousins, one of our key producers, is going to be sitting in for me. He's got Mike Berg discussing and Howard Nations discussing this longstanding war on the government by Republicans to where we lose confidence in the government and the regulations are out the window and corporations take everything they want. Cliff Schechter is going to be talking about the idea of safety net programs disappearing and how Democrats are as much responsible as Republicans. Attorney Nancy Feinman is going to talk about the Madoff-style Ponzi schemes that banks like J.P. Morgan have engaged in that we've barely paid attention to. Elliot Feinman, National Gun Victims Action, is going to talk about gun violence and how our failure to take serious action in the streets is going to just going to propel it. Alternate World editor Alex Cannett is going to talk about the drones of Obama and how in this last Yemen strike, it's very clear they were totally unjustified.
Yeah, yeah. And not just unjustified. There are some people who are suggesting that for every terrorist we kill, we produce 80.
Yes.
And that's a conservative ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you spread that across the entire country, I mean, it boggles my mind.
We do everything we can to make them hate us more, don't we, Tom?
It seems, and you wonder if that, you know, we've talked about before about perverse incentives, about how if you privatize the prison industry, you're going to end up with a for-profit industry that's going to argue for stronger sentences and longer, you know, imprisonments, which has happened. You wonder if the drone industry wants people to hate us, and you know, so they're lobbying for more use of drones.
Well, it's working. There's no way that you can ever change the culture of violence. When we have to do certain things that we do. There's no question. I'm not a dove, totally. But I'm saying let's be honest with ourselves. If you kill enough family members, in places like Yemen. The other family members are going to try to retaliate, and it's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, I think of two quick examples. Hugo Chavez, when he was alive, was supplying heating oil to people in the Northeast. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
one of the Kennedy brothers was helping administer it.
Yeah, Patrick Kennedy.
Mm-hmm. And it got him all kinds of goodwill. On the other hand, just imagine, I mean, Mexico's got this big problem with narco-terrorists. I mean, they go in and they don't just shoot up a town, they kill every single police officer in the town. What if they identified a narco-terrorist who was living in a house in Phoenix, Arizona, sent a drone over Phoenix, blew up that house, and blew up the three or four houses around it, and just said, well, I'm sorry, it's collateral damage. How would America respond to the country of Mexico?
Well, what we're not able to do is we're so able to isolate what we want to see in any fact situation. There's been some great material written about it by very capable psychologists that we have taken that to a whole new level of success, and they say it has to do with the onset of what we watch on television, what we listen to on radio, what we read in magazines, that the justification, our ability to stand outside of the event and say it doesn't affect us and ignore the obvious, we've gotten very good at it. As a matter of fact, we've evolved, I think is the way it's put, we've evolved to be able to do that better.
Yeah, denial is more than just a river in Egypt. Mike Papantonio, it's always great to see you. Sunday at noon Eastern Time, right here on Free Speech TV, Ring of Fire Television, and of course, every single day it repeats. Check out freespeech.org and ringoffireradio.com for when. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Pap, great to see you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And Daryl in Duncansville, Pennsylvania. Hey, Daryl, you wanted to respond to an earlier caller about taxes?
Yeah, Tom, I don't know. Where do they get these ideas that we're paying higher taxes than we ever did? That's not the truth. All they have to do is search back in the taxes of years ago. My God.
Yeah, tax rates are actually lower now than they've been since the 1950s. Yeah, our tax rates.
No, my gosh.
Go ahead.
I don't understand where these people get these notions. I guess soon as Boehner comes out and said we're overtaxed, I guess that's law, I guess.
They
I guess
get them gone. From the Koch brothers. You know, the billionaires don't, you know, they're scared to death that we're going to raise their taxes back to where they were before Reagan became president. And so, you know, they say, ah, we're taxed too much. Now, nobody likes paying taxes. I mean, you know, it's just kind of a universal principle all the way back to the Sheriff of Nottingham. And so people think, oh, they must be talking about me. You know, and you know, the fact of the matter is that a large chunk of the American workforce, probably 30% or so of Americans who actually work for a living, pay very little to nothing in at least in terms of income taxes. But they adopt this mentality from the multimillionaires that they see on TV and on the radio. You know, these guys who are on network television and major network radio, they're very wealthy people. And so they're, you know, Rush Limbaugh, you know, he said, I'm going to leave New York City if they raise taxes on rich people. Why? Well, he's got a $400 million contract, and that might have something to do with it. So, but his listeners don't know that, and they think he's just a working stiff, and it's like, oh, well, you know, they must be coming after me, too. So you're right, Derek.
But can't they see that they're paying more for gas, oil, and electricity, and these companies are making huge profits, and not only that, there they get taxed. Tax subsidies to boot. That's
yep.
ridiculous.
Yep. I think people are starting to wake up to it, and that's the good news. Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. Rob in East Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hey, how you doing today, Tom? Great
good.
Show. I want a question. Will Bill Clinton, he balanced the budget. I mean, I just enthralled in how he did it, you know, and then what happened to all the money, you know? It was, you know, he balanced it. It was great. And then what I heard, I'm not sure if it's true, that all the gas tax, you know, the 100% or whatever we get on gas, that 10% pays for all the roads and everything else, but the 90% is gone missing.
No, that's not true.
Third part,
the gas.
Okay, all right.
Okay, let's just deal with these one at a time, and you can, I'll keep you on the line. You can come to your next one. Number one. The principal two ways that Bill Clinton balanced the budget were, number one, raising taxes on rich people and on corporations by a very small percentage, by about 3.5%. And number two, and this was actually a larger part of how Clinton balanced the budget, is he was in the middle of a bubble, a boom. There was so much economic activity. People were making so much money, and they were paying taxes on that. And once we slid into a recession after 2001, after 9/11, we slid into that recession, and instantly we were in deficit territory. And that was before Bush had even had a chance to do his tax cuts. I mean, he'd done one small one, but that was even before he'd had a chance to do his big tax cuts or have his wars. So, you know, right now, if the economy was going well, if the Republicans had not laid off 600,000 people in the states, and the federal government had not laid off 300,000 people since Barack Obama came to office, you would have another million people working. That would, just those people drawing good government paychecks, would create at least another 2 million jobs, because, you know, people have to, they take that money and they spend it, and, you know, it goes through the economy. And so we would have far less of a debt or a deficit now if we had an economy that was working. That's the big key. The number one, you know, the way the Dwight Eisenhower, when Eisenhower became president, our debt was 124% of GDP. You know, it was the debt from World War II. He did not cut anything to pay that off. Instead, he grew the economy. And as the economy grows, as people get more prosperous, particularly the middle class, because the middle class pays income taxes, as people became more, rather than, you know, stashing their money in Switzerland or someplace like Mitt Romney does, where for 10 years in a row Mitt Romney paid no income taxes at all. When the middle class is prosperous, then the government becomes prosperous, and the debt from World War II is paid off by growing the middle class. It was that simple. And we could do the same thing now, except Republicans do not want it to happen because they don't want the legacy of a Democratic presidency to be economic success. What was the second point you made?
Because
the gas tax. 100% of the gas tax. The problem with the gas tax is it was never indexed to inflation. So it's not like, you know, the gas tax is being used up somehow. It's that there's not enough of a gas tax. We've got, you know, the gas tax was set at, I think, 17 cents a gallon or something back, you know, decades ago, and it's still there. You know, we haven't raised the gas tax in way too long. It should have been set to inflation. So, you know, back when gas was 40, 50, 60 cents a gallon, that was it was 20% of the cost of gas. Now it's like a fraction of that. It should have been indexed to inflation. And if it was, gasoline would be a little more expensive, but we'd have enough money to fix our roads and bridges. What was the third question you had, Rob?
Yeah, the last one was, I'm not sure, but with the bonds, that I heard that the Federal Reserve and our Social Security are the two biggest buyers of the debt of bonds in this country.
They're not the biggest buyers. They're the biggest holders, yes.
The holders. So yes. we're keep buying the debt, and then like China and Russia are dumping it, or they're
not sure how that works. China and Russia are quite happy. China holds a little over $1 trillion worth of U.S. debt, and they're quite happy to do it. It's an investment. You have to keep in mind that our public debt is somebody else's private investment. Somebody's got $1 trillion, China in this case. They want to put it someplace and get a 2% return on it every year and know that it's safe and it's always going to produce a return. So they buy our debt. That's a good thing for them, and it's a good thing for us. There's nothing wrong with that. Social Security has $2.7 trillion in surplus right now, and they got to put that money someplace. What's the best place to put it? The best investment on earth, the safest investment on earth, assuming the Republicans don't try and, you know, blow up the debt ceiling. Safest investment on earth is U.S. Treasuries. So Social Security has invested in U.S. Treasuries. That's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Rob, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with Eisenhower wasn't a peace president, Kirk says. Well, that should be interesting. Stick around. The bad and the very, very preparatiously ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good, the U.S. Department of Energy. On Wednesday, the department announced its newest initiative, the Rooftop Solar Challenge. Although the cost of solar panels themselves has dropped sharply over the past few decades, administrative costs, the cost, for example, of installation permits, stuff like that, remains pretty high. And that's where the Rooftop Solar Challenge comes in. The Energy Department is investing $12 million in a competition that pits 8 teams from places like the City University of New York and the Clean Energy States Alliance against each other to try to find the most efficient way to reduce solar costs. Solar is the way of the future. It's about time our government got serious about it. The bad. Guns and Ammo magazine. The popular firearms magazine created an uproar among conservatives this week when it published an article by contributing editor Dick Metcalf that embraced gun control. But any goodwill with gun control advocates Gun and Ammo may have bought itself has now expired. That's because the magazine fired Dick Metcalf earlier today. Guns and Ammo chief editor Jim Beckett announced the move online, saying that his publication's commitment to the Second Amendment is unwavering. Let's be honest, though. Metcalf's firing has nothing to do with ideology and everything to do with the pressure Guns and Ammo faces from its gun industry advertisers. And the very, very ugly Pocatello High School. The Idaho High School fired its girls' basketball coach, Lorraine Cook, late last month, when it discovered that she had posted a suggestive picture of her fiancé, Tom Harrison, grabbing her breast on Facebook. While a teacher getting fired over a racy photo isn't really news, what makes Cook's case so screwed up is that her fiancé is also an employee of Pocatello High School, and he's keeping his job. He's the high school's football coach, for what it's worth. This is a case of gender double standards at their worst, and that is very, very ugly. It's incredibly ugly. So, anyhow, welcome back. And Kirk, you know, I wasn't portraying Dwight Eisenhower as, Mr. McGovern, but he did run against the war in Korea. Kirk in Bothell, Washington, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for so diligently and responsibly using our free airwaves and sharing them with me. And I wasn't in any way accusing you of that. And I was listening to Amy Goodman interview Oliver Stone earlier this week, and Oliver Stone posits that by the end of Eisenhower's second term, he was advocating using nuclear weapons tactically in a first strike manner against Russia to end the Cold War before it really got started because we had such a superior weapons advantage at the time.
Did Stone tell you that during the last year of Eisenhower's presidency, he basically was not in the White House, he basically was not president, he'd had a massive heart attack, and Richard Nixon was pretty much running our government during the last year of the Eisenhower administration?
Well, he did say that the generals were incredibly involved in government, and that in the Bay of Pigs fiasco, that they were putting all kinds of pressure on Kennedy. And Stone's position is that Kennedy saved the world at that moment.
Yeah, I think he did. But the other thing that Stone may or may not have told you is that the Bay of Pigs was planned by Richard Nixon as vice president in late 1959 and early 1960. It was planned as an invasion of Cuba that was going to happen in the fall of 1960 during the election campaign between Richard Nixon and Jack Kennedy. Because the main thing that Kennedy was using to beat up Nixon in that election was the fact that Nixon had been in charge of the whole Cuba thing. You know, when the Cuban Revolution happened in 58, originally we thought that Castro was going to be a good guy, and we sort of helped him out. And then he turned to the Soviet Union and said, no, I'm going to become a communist. And there were a number of people in the revolution itself who felt betrayed, who left Cuba and came to the United States, and you know that whole story. But anyhow... So Nixon, the only way that Nixon could get out from underneath Kennedy just beating him up for letting Cuba go communist, which was working incredibly successfully for Kennedy, was to invade Cuba. And so Nixon put together the Bay of Pigs as an October surprise for the election of 1960, the same way Nixon blew up the Vietnam talks in the election of 68. I mean, Nixon was really good at using international incidents traitorously, treasonously, in order to win elections. And it didn't happen. And it didn't happen, as I recall, because of a weather event, because of a giant storm that went through or something. There was something that blew it up. Lamar Waldron could give you all the details on this. And so Kennedy came into office inheriting this thing, not even knowing it was there for the first year that he was president.
Right, yeah. Stone has kind of fleshed that out. He sounds like as much of a passionate Kennedy historian as you are. If I could change direction a little bit and talk about Sherrod Brown too.
Sure.
Thank God that Sherrod Brown is taking a no BS position on this opening that exists for bipartisan negotiations after the shutdown. Because you know, I don't know. You're probably well aware that during this week I've read that. Air quote, sensible people in Washington are proposing raising the retirement age for Social Security to 70 years old as a solution to the problem.
Yeah, which is insane.
Yeah, right. I mean, I've heard your rants about how it should be 55 and create employment opportunity. But,
that's right.
You know, thank God that Sherrod Brown is throwing out a no BS proposal. And hopefully people like Senator Durbin are listening right now.
Yeah, because Sherrod Brown, and here's the essence of Sherrod Brown's proposal. Lift the cap so that Bill Gates pays the same amount in Social Security as everybody else does, number one. And then with that money, give everybody on Social Security roughly a $70 raise every month. And number three, change the cost of living adjustment calculation for Social Security to one that is unique to people who are on Social Security. Because right now, the way the federal government calculates cost of living, i.e. inflation, the way that they calculate that includes things like, you know, iPads that get cheaper and cheaper every year and get more and more powerful, and cell phones and computers. And people who are retired are typically not buying a new iPad every year, but they are buying pharmaceuticals every year, and those prices are going up rapidly. Food prices are going up rapidly. Housing prices are going up rapidly. And healthcare prices are going up rapidly. And those are not reflected in the CPI. And if the your air quotes reasonable people, I'm with you, have their way and we get a chain CPI, it's going to get even worse. And so, yeah, Sherrod Brown is a hero in this thing. And it's a shame that the media is not giving it even 1/100th of the coverage that they give anything that Rand Paul or Ted Cruz say. Because Sherrod Brown is speaking truth to power and he's making sense. Kirk, thanks for the call. Seth in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Seth, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm well. What's up?
Can you hear me well?
Just fine.
Okay. I think you buy into the economy a little bit more than you should.
Okay, give me an example.
Well, I think that the work that we do in the workforce is at the very best, uninteresting and senseless.
Well, it's true for about half the workers.
For about half the workers, yeah, I was going to say. And I think that we need to be working at work and in education throughout our lives at work that we love to do rather than what we are forced to do.
I agree.
Or led to do. I also.
On the other hand, you know, Seth, somebody's got to build the roads, somebody's got to wash the toilets, somebody's got to, you know, mop the floors. And,
yeah.
You know, and there are some people who actually feel that that's their calling, you know, who are, you know, who can be enthusiastic about doing what you might consider a menial task, and God bless them. But there's a lot of people, as you point out, you know, I mean, the last survey I saw was about a year and a half ago, and it suggested that roughly half of Americans enjoy their work, and roughly half of the Americans are doing it because they've got to pay the rent, and they would much rather be fishing.
Right, but I don't really buy that. I don't really buy that. I have a mental illness, and I've worked in low-income jobs my entire time that I was in the workforce, and I really, really resented it. I have a college degree,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very smart, and I really thought it was awful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can do better than that.
Yeah, I do too. Where do you start?
Well, I think that in the workforce in general, we need to be encouraged to work at jobs and in education in what we love to do. And I think that we need to figure out how to do that. I don't know what the answer is, but I think that in education at least, when we go to college, when we go to trade school, we shouldn't have a thought about what we're going to do for work. But towards the end of that, we should have highly experienced counselors and native elders who teach us how to turn that work and education towards the workforce.
I don't disagree. I can tell you just from my own personal experience of having been in the workplace for, you know, geez, over 40 years now, close to 45 years having been in the workforce, that during the times when the economy was really roaring, it was much easier for people to find work that they really loved. And during the times when the economy really sucks, like right now, it's much harder for people to find work that they really love, and people end up with work that they're having to settle for. And that's a strong argument for doing the basic government policy stuff that we've done in this country before. We know how to do it, that puts the economy back together. But the Republicans will have none of that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Seth, thank you for the call. And therefore, you know, the strategy becomes we've got to figure out a way to get some good progressives in office. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mike, watching Free Speech TV in Lebanon, Missouri. You wanted to share a positive experience with Obamacare, Mike?
Well, I think it's positive that I think that the intentions of Mr. Obama and the administration, I think, are all good. But ultimately, I think what it says is that in this country that not only do you not have a right to receive medical treatment or medication if you're poor, but now they're going to enact laws that make it illegal to not be healthy,
mm-hmm.
to not maintain health insurance will be a fine, and if you don't pay the fine, you'll go to jail.
Right.
Same way as it is with auto insurance, that whenever you get to a point in a society where the people that are preyed upon are the most vulnerable, the other people are responsible for doing something about that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is being done around us, and you know, you see, your audience sees what's going on around us, that we cannot just passively sit back and do nothing while people, you know, that there's $12 billion that Diamond got or that Diamond has to pay. People don't remember that we just paid them $800 billion. So we didn't get any money. We just got some of our money back. They didn't pay a fine. They just gave us a small refund. So I'm just frustrated that all these, or that whenever you speak, that you speak a lot about Democrats and Republicans and play one against the other. that, you know, you have, I know you have real good intentions, but you're, but it isn't a matter of Republicans. Really, I think ultimately comes down to who has money and who doesn't have money. And in this country, no matter what color you are or what political party you're with, if you don't have money, you don't have power and you don't have a voice in this democracy. And the majority of the people out there would not even know the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, what those two documents even say. They're just told that they should be a patriot because we have those, but they don't really ever bother to read them to see what they mean.
So
it's not the fault of the bankers that they're not going to jail, because they just understand what those documents mean, and we don't.
No, they understand. They understand how the Supreme Court has interpreted them over the last 40 years.
Yeah, yeah, and you know that, that about people and all this is ridiculous. That these people that are supposed to be there to help a democracy, that whenever they keep making rulings like that, that I think are absurd.
But Mike, you've got a lot of people who don't have a lot of money, who are members of the Teamsters, who are members of the AFL-CIO, who are members of the Teachers Union, and because they happen to be in a union, they actually do have power. They actually do have a voice in Washington, D.C. They actually do get candidates elected and legislation passed. Not enough, and not anywhere near enough. You know, they don't have the kind of money the Koch brothers have or the Walmart heirs have, but they've got something. And it seems to me that as long as we're stuck in this system that has been created by our Supreme Court, by this constitutional monarchy that we have, which says that, as you correctly point out, money equals power, that we need to have more effective ways for people to come together and form those kind of organizations, basically unions. And so I think, frankly, one of our top priorities should be passing card checks to make it easier for people to unionize. And the Republicans understand this, by the way, which is why they just tried to, in the United States Senate, they just tried to amend the Employee Non-Discrimination Act, the Gay Rights Act. They just tried to amend that to put right to work for less in every state in the country on it, because they get it. You know, that if people don't have unions, they got nothing. That's the last thing we've got. Mike, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, nah, not so much. Don't think so. Oh, my. Jason in Chicago. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind?
Hi, I wanted to ask a quick question. Actually, two questions. One of them was, and it kind of goes with the theme that we've been speaking about this afternoon, and that is the complicity, I guess I would call it, of large public pension systems and their investments in private equity. And I don't hear very many progressives talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
This issue of, you know, we rail against the Wall Street banksters and we see them for what they are, but we never call out our pension systems for being complicit with these guys and making large-scale investments in private equity and Wall Street.
Well, you know, you say to your pension manager, your job, and the pension managers are typically fairly well-paid people, say, not multi-millions, but I mean, you know, they're making six figures. You say your job is to handle this $3 billion and, or, you know, $300 million or $30 million and to do it in a way that produces the greatest rate of return for our members. And if investing it with, you know, SAC Capital is going to do that, who had over 25% rate of return every year for the last decade. Now, it turns out it was because, you know, Stephen Cohen was, if I'm remembering names right here, was operating on, or at least people in his organization were operating on, insider information, or at least so the government is alleging. But nonetheless, if it turns out that that's where you're going to get the best rate of return, I can understand why a pension would do that. You know, there's a big divestment thing right now to get pensions and everybody else out of fossil fuels. And I think that that not only makes a lot of sense with regard to the fossil fuels, but also it makes a lot of sense economically, because at some point, these companies, when we start taxing carbon, these companies are going to have to start taking their reserves off their books, which is going to crash their stock value. But I don't disagree with you about
that. How can we make moral judgments, moral arguments against, for instance, what happens on Wall Street,
right,
if our own public pension systems are some of their largest investors?
Right. Well, how would you propose taking that up with the people who are handling the public pension systems?
Well, I mean, I think you would focus primarily on safer, maybe government-backed investments like treasuries, that sort of thing.
And well, I think after 2008, you're seeing a lot more of that.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
The other question I had was, you know, I would tend to agree with a lot of the issues we have, for instance, with corporations like Walmart and how they've used welfare reform to their advantage.
Mm-hmm.
My question, though, and I say this sort of with a little bit of self-reflection, is how many of us who call ourselves progressives are still shopping at places like Walmart? And if you really have an issue with how they're treating their workers and how in the business model that they're using, quite a few of us are still going in there to save a few dollars.
Yeah.
And I wonder how many of us are really, at the end of the day, you know, driving your car that extra mile to go to that independent business or that small business. I think a lot of folks, even though they may say one thing, are still driving the car and pulling into Walmart because they want to save a few extra quarters.
Well, the fact of the matter is, in large parts of this country, Walmart's all there is. They put pretty much everybody else out of business. I remember living in Montpelier, Vermont, and I wanted to buy a new pillow, right? We just bought a house. I wanted to buy some new pillows. And I, you know, I looked around because there was a Walmart in the next town over, and which was about 12 miles from us. And I couldn't find a place that sold pillows within at least a 70 or 80 mile radius. So what do? You go to Walmart.
Well, I just think that we need to really start looking for some more alternatives, and it may take a little extra effort.
I think the alternative is to do it at the legislative level. Rather than blaming the victims, rather than blaming the consumers, what we need to do is, I think, frankly, we should be adopting some variation on the Sherman Antitrust Act and saying these companies are too large, they're monopolizing marketplaces, they have to break up, either number one. Or number two, even go with what India has, or at least had until the last year or so, is for a long, long time, they had a law that no company or family could own more than two retail stores in the entire country. And so you had an incredibly diverse retail sector. It wasn't as efficient as Walmart, but a whole lot more people were employed, a whole lot more people were well paid, there was a greater diversity of goods and services. It was a good thing for India. And, of course, Walmart went over and just lobbied like crazy to get that changed, and I believe that the Indian legislature changed that last year. But that's the sort of thing I think, you know, okay, we've seen the experience. We've seen what it does to us, and we've seen what it does to our economy. Now, how do we do something about it? I don't think that we do it by shaming consumers, although that happens. I think you do it by changing the rules of the game of business, because Walmart is just using the rules of the game of business. So, Jason, thank you for the thought-provoking call. Christopher in Midland, Texas. Hey, Christopher, what's up?
Hi, how are you? Tom, I was calling. I found it interesting listening yesterday to Sean Hannity, how he has such disdain towards someone like Chris Christie, and in his logic, it seems like in the far right, they think that these Tea Party candidates are more electable than, I guess, the non-Tea Party Republicans. And when you look at the data, it does not back that up at all. I mean, they had a Tea Party candidate run in New Jersey who lost to Cory Booker a couple weeks ago. And I don't understand where he's coming from, because it seems like from his perspective, he's actually hurting his party as far as winning elections.
Well, think about this for a minute, Christopher. And I'm in this business, so you could say I'm talking out of school, but I don't think this is any kind of secret. What was the number one thing that increased Rush Limbaugh's ratings in the history of his show? The thing that catapulted him from being a relatively obscure right-wing talk show host into being one of the most famous guys in America. It was Bill Clinton being elected president.
Yeah.
When Bill Clinton was president, Rush Limbaugh was at his zenith. When George W. Bush was president, Rush Limbaugh saw his revenue drop off. The best thing for talk radio is for the opposition to be in power. Now, I understand that equation. My show would make more money if Mitt Romney was president right now, because, you know, there'd be more people who were really, really upset, and they'd be tuning into Progressive Talk Radio to find out what to do about it. But I'm not willing to damage the Democratic Party in order to make that happen. I'm not saying that Sean Hannity is trying to damage the Republican Party because he wants Democrats to win because it'll increase his ratings. But you have to scratch your head sometimes and wonder about the logic of people like Hannity and Limbaugh, who've been around the block. I mean, these guys have been in the business for decades. They know when the Democrats are in control, they make more money.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Breaking news. And Cameron Stouth is going to break it. He's a journalist. He's the author of his most recent book, In the Name of God, The True Story of the Fight to Save Children from Faith-Healing Homicide. And it's serious stuff. And the book is out. It's in bookstores all over the country right now, and really an astounding read. Cameron, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
First of all, tell me about this faith-healing homicide. What is faith-healing homicide?
That's when you don't take your kids to a doctor and they die. And, you know, at first I was thinking that's not as bad as shooting your child or drowning your child in a bathtub. But then the more you think about it, some of these kids lie around for weeks, months, years in agony, and then they die. And honest to God, I think that's probably worse than being shot by your own parents.
And the parents are doing this because they are members of Christian cults that assert that prayer, it will heal all illnesses if you truly believe enough, and that modern medicine is wrong, unnecessary, from the devil. What?
Well, if you're born holy, which is what they consider themselves, then you have no risk at all. God will take care of you no matter what happens, and even if you die, you go straight to heaven, which is nice because everybody else who has ever been born goes straight to hell. If your kids die, it's no big deal. Everybody in the church loves you more than ever because you made the ultimate sacrifice, and you might be next in line to be the new prophet.
Now, this sounds like crazy talk, Cameron, but you have investigated one of the largest of the cults of this type in the United States. It's right there outside Portland, Oregon, and made a startling discovery just in the last few days here.
Yes. A colleague of mine, Dan Tilken of KATU TV, it's the ABC affiliate here in Portland, he is going to announce in 4 hours that in one of the affiliates of the Church of the Followers of Christ, this one in Idaho, just across the border, that for the last 2 years, there have been more and more kids dying. It has not been reported. There will be no prosecutions because Idaho is one of the many states in which faith-based abuse and homicide is legal.
Now, wow, that's incredible. I understand that there are 133 children's graves out of a total of 300.
That's exactly right. I watched one of them being dug. And it's sickening. These people, they love their kids. They honestly do. Now, I'll tell you, one glimmer of hope is that they are not your average perp. They will respond to the system if the system responds to them by making this illegal. They're not homicidal maniacs.
Right.
They're not drug abusers. They can be reasoned with. But
so, in other words, if they lived in a state where refusing to give your child antibiotics when they have pneumonia and they're dying, or some even worse disease, you know, MRSA or something. If living in a state where you could actually go to jail for not treating your child when they're sick or refusing to give your child insulin if they're diabetic.
Yeah. Then they would do it.
They would simply go along with it. I mean, as Christian scientists have all over the country for years and years, I mean, this is not the first religion to come along and say you can pray away sickness.
That's right. Now, in the cases we had here in Oregon, there were four of them. In the very first one, it was a death of a two-year-old girl. She had a horrible thing on her neck that starved her and suffocated her over a long period of time. Father got 90 days in jail, wife got off. The second one, little girl went blind, 90 days in jail for both parents. Then another one, the third one, parents go to prison for 6 years, and in one that's coming up, it's going to be 10 years. And it's making an impact.
The cult members in Oregon are starting to take their kids to the doctor when their kids get sick. But in Idaho, it's illegal to prosecute them for this?
Yeah, it is. I've talked to the prosecutor there, and he was only too happy to get rid of me. He thought I was just a pest for even wondering why I would be attacking freedom of religion.
America. Seriously?
Yeah, that's how they frame it as freedom of religion. It's not freedom of religion. It's freedom of child abuse.
Do these people also use their... I mean, I know there are some people who use religion to justify beating their children. Do they do that also, or is this just limited to medicine?
Some of these crimes... I cried every day when I wrote some of these chapters. A guy beating his daughter to death with a stick... making her brother watch. No prosecution.
Whoa. Because he was what, beating the devil out of her?
He was a preacher. He was beating the devil out of her. They believe the devil gets in you and they'll sit on you. The exorcism is very, very common. They kidnap people. They kidnap old people, elderly people. I know a case in which two grown men sat on their elderly father as he cried and begged to go to the hospital. And finally he gave up and died. His
wow.
son.
Wow. And this is a Christian cult. These are Christian cults. And
if you want to call that Christianity.
Yeah, well, they call themselves Christian cults. Let's say that. We're talking with Cameron Stouth. His new book is In the Name of God, The True Story of the Fight to Save Children from Faith-Healing Homicide. And, you know, breaking news, they've just found one of these cemeteries filled with children's graves. I'm assuming these children don't get vaccinated either. Are they dying of preventable illnesses?
There are massive outbreaks of epidemics. It's been going on forever. Hundreds of kids will get sick in one of these communes.
Wow. And is there any, you know, if it's illegal in Oregon, is there any effort to make it illegal in Idaho? I mean, how do these laws come into place in the first place that allow?
There is one American crusader, Mrs. Rita Swan. She runs an organization. The acronym is CHILD. Google CHILD Swan or Rita. Mm-hmm. And you will find that there's one person who has dedicated her life from going state to state, changing laws. She's been doing this for more than 30 years, and she alone has pretty much revamped the American landscape in regard to faith healing abuse.
How many states have laws like Idaho's that allow parents to kill their children by medical neglect in the name of Jesus?
Almost all states have some kind of shield or another. Only five states have none at all. Oregon, thank God, is now one of them, but that's only been happening for about a year.
I lived in Oregon, you know, back 3 years ago, and I remember when this cult had a couple of their kids die, and there was a big kerfuffle about it. Did that provoke the legislature to do away with the shield?
It did, but they still had to be pushed because legislators, you know, freedom of religion.
Right.
You know?
Right. This seems like, I mean, you know, letting your children die seems like it goes beyond freedom of religion. You know, I understand, oh, I don't want a transfusion for religious reasons. Well, okay, I'll take it if, you know, if my life is at risk. You know, I mean, even the the Jehovah's Witnesses. Usually, when they hit the point where their life is at risk, they'll break down and say, okay, damn it, do it.
Yeah, but there was a kid who died in Washington State just last year. Jehovah's Witness, no, I don't want a transfusion, you know.
Yeah.
That would be unholy. Judge said, no, you're going to get a transfusion. They fought it and fought it. Finally, judge said, put his foot down. Kid died the same day.
Wow. Cameron Stouth, the book In the Name of God. Check it out. Cameron, thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate your help.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Breaking news on our show here that 133, a mass grave of children in Idaho, Caldwell, Idaho, just found. Wow, that's intense. That is intense. Whew. Joyce, watching Free Speech TV in Sylmar, California. Hey, Joyce, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
A couple of things. One, I think the gentleman that called and said that it wasn't Republicans and Democrats is totally wrong. Democrats look out for the poor and the middle class, and the Republicans could care less.
To an extent, I agree. There are some Democrats who have sold out, but I don't think the majority of the
party
has.
There are always a few somewhere.
Sure.
And another one was the Supreme Court. They're supposed to interpret laws according to the Constitution, but we have ourselves an activist Supreme Court.
Yes.
And they're doing far above what they're supposed to be doing.
Yes. They are more aggressive than I think any Supreme Court has been in history, or certainly since the Lochner Court.
They were sure more aggressive than our Congress.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And finally, what I really called about is Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much of the general public is aware that Congress has taken $2.63 trillion from the Social Security Fund in the last 40 years.
They have not.
They have not?
They have not. That is right-wing disinformation designed to make you doubt Social Security and make you believe the lies that are being spread by the Wall Street bankers, people like Pete Peterson, who want you to go along with privatizing Social Security. There is the Social Security Trust Fund. Let me explain it. Here, there's two ways to describe it, Joyce. The Social Security Trust Fund has $2.7 trillion in it. They've got a surplus. Because back in the second year of the Reagan administration, they said, okay, we got the baby boomers coming. It's going to be like a rabbit moving through a python. So we're going to double tax the baby boomers. So they not only pay for their parents' retirement, but they pay for their own retirement. And so we're going to start accumulating this money. Social Security had never before had a trust fund. It was always, you know, it paid as it went. So they've got this giant savings account. Now, what do they do with this money? Do you put the money in Wall Street and then lose it when the stock market crashes in 2008? No. What Wall Street did was they said, we're going to put this money in U.S. Treasuries because U.S. Treasuries are the safest investment there is. U.S. Treasuries pay a steady, you know, 1%, 2%. It's not a lot, but they pay it, and they pay it every year, and they've never failed to pay it since George Washington was president. Now, what the right-wingers say is Treasuries are debt instruments. When the government spends more money than it brings in, it borrows money, which is true. And so when George Bush wanted to have a war in Iraq, he had to borrow $1 trillion to have his war. So he issued treasuries. It's borrowed money, and it got spent on the war in Iraq. And some of those treasuries were bought by the Social Security Administration. So you could say, you know, this is a classic example of, you know, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. You could say that the Social Security Trust Fund has loaned $2.6 trillion to the United States government, which has been spent by George Bush for his wars. And it would be arguably true, but the fact of the matter is that they're sitting on these treasury bills, and when they come due, the federal government will pay them back. We have never failed to pay them back. We may have to raise taxes to pay them back. We may have to do something else, but we always pay them back. So the money has not been taken from Social Security. Social Security has invested in government treasuries, which is the best thing it could do. It's the right thing to do. Joyce, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And yes, the crash of 2016. I will be next week Next Thursday, I'll be in Chicago at the Frugal Muse, and next Saturday, a week from Saturday, I'll be in Minneapolis at the Operating Engineers Hall, autographing books. The one in Minneapolis is a ticketed event. For tickets, go to AM 950 Radio, and that includes, the cost of the ticket includes a book and a meal and drinks and me. So get over to AM950Radio.com if you're in the Minneapolis area, or if you want to come up to the Minneapolis area and check that out. And then there's more cities coming on, but that's just next week. That's Thursday and Saturday not this Saturday, but a week from Saturday, is the 16th, the 14th and the 16th of November. So it's going to be interesting. We're starting the book tour. The official release date of the book is the 12th of November, I believe. But it's starting to show up in bookstores now, and if you want to read it at no cost at all, you can contact your local library and ask them to get a copy. So, anyhow. Joshua in Boise, Idaho. Hey, Joshua.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine. You are an attorney in Iowa, or in Idaho, rather, and you're familiar with this cult that is allowing their children to die?
No, I'm not familiar with the cult. I'm just familiar with child protection laws here, and I think the last caller just misstated the law a little bit. It's not legal for child abuse to take place in Idaho and hide behind religion. The freedom of religion is apparent, but practices of religion are definitely curbed whenever there's abuse of children, and that goes for Christian Scientists or anyone else. The problem is, in the smaller towns, like in a lot of states, I think, just people aren't watching. Same as what happened with the Catholic Church, and it's kind of looking the other way.
With the pedophile scandal.
That's a problem, but there's nothing on the books in Idaho that allows them to do that. It's only officials looking the other way that allows them to do that.
I would encourage you to get a copy of Cameron Stouth's book, In the Name of God, or contact him. He doesn't have a website, but... So I'm not sure, although if you Google him, maybe you can find his email address. But he lives in the Portland area. But he was pretty clear that he went to Idaho and he talked to the local prosecuting attorney in the county in which this mass grave was found and this cult is located. And he said on the air just a minute ago, that guy couldn't wait to get rid of me. He does not want to prosecute these families.
Yeah, and that is a problem. The prosecutors, in smaller towns choose which crimes they want to prosecute, and that's a major problem. But there's nothing. My point was there isn't anything legally that allows them to do that. He's operating outside the law when the prosecutor's doing that.
Very interesting.
That's a horrible thing. It's just nothing legally that is allowing him to do that.
Yeah. Okay, Joshua. Thanks for the heads up on that. Again, I encourage you to check out the book. I think you'll be boggled, but thank you. Thank you very much. Fran in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Fran, you might be a Republican.
Yes.
If?
Yes, if you are completely devoid of empathy for your fellow man.
You might be a Republican. You know, we posted this on, we tweeted it and we put it on our Facebook. You know, you might be a Republican if. In fact, we started a hashtag, you might be a Republican. And here's some of the responses. This is from op-ed writer. He says, if you call stay-at-home moms lazy for not working outside of home and career moms selfish for not staying home. Here's one from Arselson. It says, you might be a Republican if you want government just small enough to fit into every woman's vagina. Here's one from Elise Davis. You might be a Republican if you think neither you nor anyone in your family will ever get ill. Another one from Lid2Debone. It says, if you might be a Republican if you've ever begun a sentence with, I'm not a racist, but this one from Move and Shake. You might be a Republican if you think making it harder to vote while making it easier to acquire guns is good governing. And over on Facebook, Jeremy wrote, you might be a Republican if you think Fox News is real. And Dump Out the Tea wrote, you might be an American if you believe the Founding Fathers were Christians. So we've got a meme going here. Fran, thank you for contributing to it. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Thank you very much. Peggy in Bend, Oregon. Hey, Peggy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. So you're going to be selling your body in Minneapolis?
My body. I will shake hands, yes, even though it's cold season.
Okay, this call is from a household that currently keeps an orange male cat and who several years ago lost an orange male cat, so I'm so sorry about Higgins.
Thank you.
What I'm calling about today is the Initiative 522 in Washington, the GMO
right.
initiative.
Right.
I hope that caller previously, you know, who said that it hasn't been decided yet, I hope he's right and that it wins, but he's probably wrong and it's going to go down like it went down in California.
I think the polling is pretty accurate, that's showing that it lost. But who knows? I mean, hope springs eternal.
Yeah, it does. But the thing is, you know, today the FDA came out and said that they're looking to ban trans fats in foods
yes.
altogether.
Yes. Mayor Bloomberg is vindicated. You recall, he banned trans fats in New York City in the restaurants there. And there were howls and screams, Sean Hannity, you know, Nanny State, all this stuff.
Yeah, I know, and he banned trans fats in large sodas, too. But the, you know, before the FDA demanded that trans fats, the presence of trans fats in foods had to be posted, you know, on labels and so forth.
Right.
The thing is, if FDA has the power to mandate the removal of trans fats, which are inimical to human health, from foods, why don't they have the power to get into the GMO controversy?
Hang on a second, I'll answer.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Very quickly, I wrote a chapter about this in my book, Unequal Protection. They don't because during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, they, quote, regulated GMOs and they allowed them. Hey, it's Thursday. It's the third hour of Thursday. That's that few minutes every week that Louise and Sean say, okay, Tom, you can talk about science. Let's get geeky on getting a good workout. Most athletes, runners, and gym rats know about hitting the wall. It's the point at which your body is so exhausted you can't continue to function, whether you're in the field or in the gym. But new research suggests that hitting the wall may be the perfect example of mind over matter, and that exhaustion may be all in your head. Researchers at the University of Kent in England wanted to figure out if mentally pumping yourself up and encouraging yourself during a workout could help fight off the effects of exhaustion. So they turned to a group of 24 healthy and physically active men and women and asked them to ride on a stationary bike until they just couldn't ride anymore. Right? Exhaustion. Researchers took physical measurements of the study members before asking each one to ride on a stationary bike until hitting the wall. As the study members rode on the bike, researchers measured their heart rates, their pedal power, their overall pace, kept track of the biker's facial muscle movements and grimaces, which are signs of physical exhaustion. And they repeatedly asked the bikers how hard the exercise was feeling on a scale of 1 to 10. After each biker's measurements and initial exercise was recorded, the group was divided into two. One group of bikers was told to continue the normal exercise routine for the next 2 weeks, while the other group was coached in using self-talk during exercise, learning how to positively talk to yourself during workouts. I can do this. This is making me feel good. I'm getting better as a result of this. That kind of stuff, right? After 2 weeks, both groups returned to the lab to take another round of exercise tests. And the bikers that had learned self-talk used it during their tests, while those who hadn't learned it didn't. What the researchers found was that the group of bikers who had talked to themselves pedaled much longer before becoming tired than in their first rides, and they reported that the exercise felt easier, even though their heart rates and facial expressions remained the same from the first exercise test, meaning that the second biking and exercise test was just as physically hard as the first one. Samuel Marcora, the senior author of the study, said that the results indicate that motivational self-talk improves endurance performance compared to not using it. He went on to say it's very possible if physical exhaustion develops primarily in the head. So the next time you head to the gym or go on a run, think some happy thoughts. You might run right past that wall. I think this applies to every part of life. I mean, there was this big fad back in like the 1850s.
1850s, 1890s, late 19th century, maybe it was the early 20th century. René Curieux, I want to say. It was some guy with a French name. He was a Frenchman. And it was this was like a worldwide fad where people would repeat a number of times a day, every day in every way, I am getting better. They would simply say it to themselves over and over and over again. And it works. Never underestimate the power of affirmation. I'm telling you, never underestimate it. It's powerful stuff. There's a book called The Magic of Believing that really, really, really changed my life in a significant way. I read it when I was maybe 21 years old. And I'm trying to remember the author's name. But when I was 21, it was a long time ago. But it was Claude Bristol. And it's called The Magic of Believing. And it is just Think and Grow Rich is another one by Napoleon Hill. These are books about using your brain to completely re-regulate how you interact with the world. And it works. This stuff works. And here we have proof of it from the world of exercise. Cynthia in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Cynthia, what's up?
Oh, my goodness. I'm so excited to be able to speak to you. I've had this great idea about solar, and so you talked about it. And here's my idea. I don't know whether you have any way of talking it up or whatever. If our federal government, you know, what we have a lot of incentive programs for businesses and government agencies to go solar. Mm-hmm. But if our federal government would give individual homeowners a low-interest loan for 10 years, say like a 2%, interest rate for a solar conversion for our roof, what we would pay in that extra payment every month would be probably less than what we're paying in electric.
What you're describing, Cynthia, is exactly what Germany did.
Now, what the good thing about this, besides getting us, you know, first of all, we have global warming.
Yeah.
So it's a no-brainer to use the enemy of our planet, the sun at the moment, for our benefit.
Yeah.
Number two, can you imagine all the jobs this would create?
Yep.
Because if individual homeowners could, a solar roof costs about $20,000, $25,000. So you pay it off over 10 years, and in 10 years, you've saved enough money on your electric bill to have paid that payment. And I don't know how to get this through to whoever the powers.
Well, here's how you get it through, Cynthia. The Germans already did this, and they did it exactly the way that you're describing it. The one thing that they added to it is that the utility has to buy excess electricity back from you so that you actually get paid by the utility. And that helps pay off the mortgage. And they did it through the private sector. They had banks issue the mortgages, but they backstopped the banks. So they were very low-interest mortgages because the banks could afford to loan at very low-interest rates because they had a 100% guarantee. If you defaulted, the government would pick up the default. So Germany did this, and they hoped to create enough solar panels on enough roofs across the country that it would equal 1 to 2 nuclear power plants over a 10-year period, because that was the projection of the need for electricity. They had to stop the program after 9 years because they had generated more than 10, and now it's more than 12, nuclear power plants worth of electricity on people's roofs. And now the challenge that the Germans have is they've got to rebuild their grid, their electric grid, to handle all this surplus electricity because they're using an older grid. But you're absolutely so. If you want to tell a legislator how to do it, just tell them to look at the German example. Do it the way the Germans did, because in Germany in August, half of that entire country's electricity was generated on some days by solar power, and it's all off people's rooftops. So brilliant, Cynthia. Thank you. You are great minds think alike, and you're right there. Carl in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine. What's on your mind?
You know, I wanted to touch on a couple of points. Maybe this was back before when you were saying that, you know, that we know how to get the economy on the track, but the Republicans will have none of it.
Yes.
And I'm saying to myself that a lot of these Republicans, I find, they're not, especially in the House, they're not well-traveled people. You know, like if you ask them if they've ever been out of the United States, they haven't gone anywhere. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I have had the honor of having parents that, you know, are from overseas. So I've gone to other places. I've seen how other people live. And people don't understand how much we take for granted. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like simple things like school lunches. They don't get that in a lot of, you know, in my father's home country. That's like school lunches? Are you kidding me?
Right.
So what I'm saying is these Republicans, they just hate Obama. That's it. That's all it's all about. We hate Obama. We hate you. We hate you. But meanwhile, like you said, there's 72,000 dilapidated bridges. Our sewer system needs to be upgraded. Our electrical grid needs to be upgraded. There's a lot of things that need to get done right now.
Yep.
And these people are just trying to run out the clock.
Yep. You're absolutely right. They, you know, if there was a Republican in the White House and Republicans controlled Congress, they would do like they did during the Bush administration, during the Reagan administration. They would be spending, and the Eisenhower administration, they would be spending money to stimulate the economy. They absolutely would. But they will not allow Barack Obama to do that because they hate him. And I think much of that hatred is based on the fact that he's African American. But I also know that, you know, they hated Bill Clinton, although they did go along with a lot of Bill Clinton's programs. But on the other hand, much of that happened when Bill Clinton had a Democratic Congress, too. So, you know, you could split that a couple of different ways. But anyhow, thank you for the call, Carl. You're just spot on. Linda in Chicago. Hey, Linda. Thanks for listening to CPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, as a follow-up to the caller earlier about the mass grave of these children who were denied medical coverage due to their Christian parent beliefs.
Right.
There's an item in the news today. A mother and father have been sentenced to decades on prison sentences. They used a book called Raising Up a Child, I think that was the name of it, something like that. And it's a Christian book on how to parent your children.
Right.
And they beat these kids, they starved them, they abused them, they hosed them down with cold water, I mean, just horrendous things. And one of them died recently.
Yeah. What state was this in?
I don't remember what state it was in.
Yeah.
It was on the web today.
Yeah.
So
I'll bet it was one of those states that no longer has a shield law that allows people to abuse their children under cover of...
They were shocked. It didn't sound... I mean, there was no mention made in the newspaper article about a community doing this. The neighbors were totally shocked by this.
Yeah.
And it felt that the couple were kind of... loners, they homeschooled their kids. The kids weren't allowed to go outside.
Right. Anyway. See, I think there's a big difference between having the freedom to practice a religion and the freedom to abuse people based on religious principles. You know, I mean, you can find in the Bible where it says that, you know, children who talk back should be put to death, that, you know, if you don't like your neighbor, you can kill him. I mean, you could find all kinds of weird things in the Bible. And if we're going to, you know, start living by entirely biblical principles, we're going to go back to the Bronze Age. We're going to go back to the standards, values, and practices, cultural norms of 3,000 years ago. And I just don't, you know, so these guys, they want to cherry pick what they're going to follow and what they're not. And it's wrong. It's just wrong. Linda, thank you for the call. And I guarantee you, 3,000 years ago, they may have said, well, you know, okay, here's the best medical practice right now. Don't eat shellfish. Well, because... you know, they were not so good for you back then. People had allergies to shellfish.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But my point is, that was the state of the art of science back then. We got a better state of the art of science now, so let's follow it. Thank you very much. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Cynthia, watching Free Speech TV in Stites, Idaho. Hey, Cynthia, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Nice to finally be able to talk to you.
Thank you.
There, we are surrounded by probably GMO canola. It's a major crop in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a rumor flying around here, and I don't know if it's true or not, but that I don't know if some of the farmers have been interviewed or how this rumor started, but supposedly there are over 3,000 pages of documentation that I think it's scientists and doctors from around the world are taking to The Hague, and they are, from what I understand,
they are classifying GMOs as a chemical weapon.
Hmm.
And they took it to the UN, and the UN, I guess, the professor from the college, I don't know what university she was teaching, she was a scientist who had done all this research on GMOs. She was fired from her position.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what university that was. But I just wondered if you have heard anything about that.
Because I have not.
So far, for me, it's just a rumor.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, we have cancer clusters around here. We have very strange health issues going on in this area.
And you think it might be the consequence of being surrounded by GMO plants? I would submit that it, you know, because many of these GMO plants, the genetic modification allows farmers to use much higher levels of herbicides and pesticides than they would normally use, levels that would normally kill the plants, but, you know, now kill the weeds, that it may be that it's the herbs and herbicides and pesticides rather than the GMO themselves that's hurting the community. But it's just speculation.
Well, I don't know.
The consequence is the same. If it wasn't, you know, if it was organic farming, you wouldn't have this problem.
Right. But what do you think now? Don't you agree? I mean, when I heard this, I went, well, of course it's a chemical weapon.
Well, you know, I think, again, it's like using the word Holocaust. You have to be very precise about your use of language. Chemical weapons are weapons. They're things that are designed to kill people. I don't believe the GMOs were designed to kill people. I think that the people who put these things together had the very best of intentions, and they thought they were going to save people's lives. And you know, some of them, this rice that has vitamin A in it, may actually save people's lives. But that said, you know, there's whenever you have a technological breakthrough, you have the unintended consequences. You know, let's split the atom, and now you've got the atomic bomb. Well, let's have nuclear power. Now you got Fukushima. I mean, you know, so I think that there is an unintended consequence to the GMOs, and the biggest part of it is this increased use of pesticides and the types, and some of the types like the BT corn, where the corn actually grows its own pesticide. And then we eat the corn. It's like that can't be good, right? It just can't be good. It seems, I mean, logic would seem to indicate so. Cynthia, I don't know the answer. And I would suggest that you do a little more research on it and find out. And if you find the answer, call us back and let us know. Thank you very much for watching Free Speech TV and phone call. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Tom Harmon here with you. Janet in Chanhassen, Minnesota. Hey, Janet, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for all you do, and I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
I've been trying to be a helper for a friend in North Carolina, and so I really got into the ACA. Mm-hmm. And now I'm kind of hooked on, I want to understand more of the history and what the differences are between Massachusetts and the ACA, and where does it go from here? You know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. These are if you want the minutia, these would be questions to put to Wendell Potter, and you might want to even check his website. There may be a way to communicate with him, WendellPotter.com. My understanding is that the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, is essentially identical to Romney Care. The Romney Care advisors, I think it was Lawrence O'Donnell, one of the guys on MSNBC, or it might have been Rachel, had them on. Had one of the guys who was the senior advisor to Romney, who put together Romney Care, who was also the senior or a senior advisor to Obama and put together Obamacare, on their television program a couple of days ago, or last week. And that, you know, Romney Care and the Affordable Care Act are essentially the same thing, and that both of them are essentially the same thing as the program that was proposed back in the late 80s by the Heritage Foundation, and that all of this is essentially the same thing as a program that was proposed by Richard Nixon back in the 1970s. So these are not new ideas. But as to the minutia, I'm sorry, I don't have the details on that. So thank you for the call, though. Lance in Denver, Colorado, listening on iHeartRadio. And by the way, thank you, Patricia, for listening to Progressive Voices. You wanted to correct something about faith healing. Do I get that right?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
Yeah, I was just calling in to correct a statement that was made by your earlier, I think it was a guest, actually, the gentleman who...
Cameron Stouth, his new book, In the Name of God. He's a reporter.
Yes, yes, there we go. About the mass grave that had apparently been located. And,
yes.
Someone was trying to get the local prosecutor to file charges,
right,
et cetera. I'm a criminal defense lawyer in Colorado. A prosecutor has absolute discretion,
right,
whether or not to file a criminal case against someone. So I just wanted to make it clear that his statement that, you know, the prosecutor was acting outside of the law, that he had no power.
Oh, no, that was a caller who said that. Cameron Stouth said.
That's true.
Yeah, what Cameron Stouth said was that there are only five states that don't have laws or part of the Constitution that guarantees religion of freedom that could be interpreted by a prosecutor to choose not to prosecute a case like this. And Oregon became one of those states just last year. And so, you know, when I lived in Portland, there were a number of children who died from lack of medical care, and it made big, big news. And so it got to the legislature, and the legislature intentionally, you know, categorically, specifically did away with or put into law the reverse of or whatever, the ability to claim freedom of religion as a defense and give that discretion to a prosecutor to not prosecute. And whereas in Idaho, there is a law that says that you can practice your religion without being molested, and therefore, you know, bad choice of words, but you get my point, at the legal sense I'm on it. And therefore, the prosecutor is choosing in this community in Idaho where they just found this grave with 300 people in it, and out of those 300, 133 of them are children, which is way out of proportion. That prosecutor is saying, I will not prosecute because I respect the religious rights of these people. Making sense?
Absolutely. Outrageous though it may be, it's yes, absolutely. Idaho is a strange place in more ways than one.
Yeah, yeah. But according to Cameron, you know, there's only a half a dozen states or fewer that don't have some variation on these shield laws where local prosecutors have the discretion to not prosecute these, you know, folks who killed their kids by medical neglect. You know, homicide by religion, faith healing homicide is what Cameron Stouth calls it in his new book, In the Name of God. So thanks, Lance, for the call, and thanks for the for verifying it. I appreciate that. Ray in Chicago. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? First, just want to say thanks for all you do. It's an honor to talk to you. You're a very intelligent person. I really appreciate you taking my call.
Thank you.
I wanted to say something about that faith-based healing, too. You know, I understand faith. I really do. It's, for some people, it's the only thing that drives them. But at some point, you got to think there's common sense. I mean, God gave us brains so that we could come up with this medical science and figure out ways that we could help ourselves. And I totally understand that people have a faith and they have a desire to do what they think is right. But I really think that in this sense, it needs to be brought on that people need to use their own brains. We have been given the gift of thought to be able to make these decisions for ourselves.
Yeah, I am totally with you, Ray. Very well said. Thank you for the call. And that's the meme to present it. You know, if God gave you the wisdom to figure out to follow your own faith, God also gave you the wisdom to figure out how to do medicine. Sonia in North Highlands, California, got a minute to the end of the show. It's yours.
Thank you, Mr. Hartman. My concern about Mr. Cameron Stouth is that are we going to blanket parents also who do not vaccinate and their children, and mothers who give birth at home, because hospitals are horrific places,
right,
to have a baby. And I don't like vaccinations on a brand new weeks old baby. Are we going to pump these poisons and these metals that come in vaccines, right, into brand new?
I think
babies?
These are all very, very separate issues. I mean, speaking as a father who delivered one of my three children at home, Louise and I had our middle child at home, and I delivered the child, our son. I don't think there's anything wrong with that or anything illegal about that. I don't think there should be. The vaccine issue is far more complex, and I don't want, well, we're out of time right now, but this is not what this guy's talking about. But what Cameron Stouth is talking about, and what he writes about in his book, In the Name of God, is people who are refusing to treat children with treatable illnesses, people who are refusing to give diabetic children insulin, for example, and then watching them die. Tomorrow, Friday, Brunch with Bernie, Anything Goes, and our new book, Crash of 2016, is out. We'll see you tomorrow. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.